This is Chapter 7, Understanding Opioid Use Disorder. On slide 96, we see that there is an intersection between chronic opioid therapy, chronic non-cancer pain, and opioid use disorder. There is an overlap of these three entities in the middle of the slide, and it is not always simple to determine if a patient has a chronic pain problem, which is being treated appropriately, or has developed an opioid use disorder if the patient is on chronic opioid therapy. This intersection is complex, and it involves great clinical skills to tease apart the different entities. One of the questions that's always been asked is, what is the risk of developing an opioid use disorder in patients who are placed on chronic opioid therapy for chronic non-cancer pain? And the answer is approximately 30%. The risk is always highest with a past history of substance use disorder or any psychiatric comorbidity. On slide 98, we are going to define addiction or opioid use disorder. Addiction and opioid use disorder or substance use disorder can be used as synonyms. The American Society of Addiction Medicine, ASAM, has an official definition of addiction. Addiction is a primary chronic disease of brain reward, motivation, memory, and related circuitry. This is reflected in an individual pathologically pursuing reward and/or relief by substance use and other behaviors. So this definition is neurobiologically based, is correct. It's a biopsychosocial model of a definition. However, it is somewhat cumbersome. On the right hand of the slide, you can see there's a more practical definition. Addiction is the continued use of drugs or activities despite knowledge of continued harm to oneself or others. So continued use despite harm is simple, and yet it is accurate and is a nice practical definition of addiction or substance use disorder. Slide 99 goes over the DSM-5 criteria for substance use disorder. What is new in the DSM-5 compared to the previous editions is that the terms addiction, abuse, and dependence are no longer used. Only substance use disorder is used that can be opioid use disorder, alcohol use disorder, cocaine use disorder. There are 11 criteria, and starting at the top, we can see the first two criteria are tolerance and withdrawal, which is synonymous with physical dependence. Those two criteria apply as long as the opioid is not being prescribed. If the opioid is being prescribed, then you cannot use those two criteria. In the middle box, we see four criteria under the heading of loss of control. And loss of control is characteristic of all substance use disorders, where people are using larger amounts for longer periods of time. They continually try to cut down, taper down, but they're not able to do that. And then they're spending more and more time around the drug use, paying for drugs, etc. And craving is also a very important component of substance use disorders, where people are thinking about what they're addicted to and looking forward to using that drug. In the bottom box, we have five criteria under the category of use despite negative consequences, and that would fit into that definition that we did on the previous slide of continued use despite harm. So you can see that there are going to be problems at work, at home, or at school. Relationships are going to be impacted by addiction. People are going to stop doing some of the activities that they used to enjoy, and their lives are going to revolve more and more around the addictive substance. There are going to be physical hazards, such as driving under the influence of the drug. And also, especially with drugs like alcohol or tobacco, there are going to be lots of physical consequences because those drugs are toxic to almost all organs in the body. And psychological harm refers to things like substance-induced psychiatric disorders. So, for example, heavy users of cocaine may develop overt psychotic symptomatology. And so these are the 11 criteria. You can download a worksheet with the DSM criteria, and when you have a new patient, you can just circle which one of the 11 criteria that they meet, and then you can see that the substance use disorder is graded as mild, moderate, or severe, depending on the number of criteria that the patient meets. On slide 100, we will talk about the fact that the DSM criteria were misleading during the prescription opioid epidemic, in the sense that if people were getting their opioids by prescription, by going to a provider, by picking it up in a pharmacy, many of the criteria that we just reviewed would not pertain. For example, spending lots of money on the drugs, or having to spend a lot of time obtaining the drugs. And so what the bottom bullet says was really true, that the harm or the development of an opioid use disorder could be masked under these conditions where somebody was having a prescription for it rather than having to obtain it illegally or illicitly. And that is why it was not known what the rates of opioid use disorder were in people who were getting chronic opioid therapy, because often the DSM did not provide the correct diagnosis. On slide 101, we will talk a little bit about terminology. And in the middle of the slide, we have opioid use disorder and addiction. On the left-hand side, we have physical dependence and tolerance, which are normal biological adaptations to taking an opioid regularly. However, developing physical dependence or tolerance does not necessarily equal opioid use disorder. It may and it may not. So, for example, if somebody is using heroin regularly and they have physical dependence and tolerance, they will definitely have an opioid use disorder because they will meet the criteria on the DSM. But someone taking properly prescribed and taking the prescription opioids as directed will have physical dependence or tolerance, but they may not have an opioid use disorder as long as there is no harm and they are taking the medications as prescribed. Let's turn to the left-hand side of the slide, where we're looking at aberrant or problematic behaviors, such as running out of your medication early, taking it for an indication that was not discussed with the provider. That requires a conversation with the patient. That requires inquiry as to why did this happen. So, for example, another common problematic behavior might be an unexpected urine drug test, where a drug that the patient was not prescribed might be detected. These are not reasons to automatically fire a patient and stop prescribing. These are opportunities for a discussion to try to sift through what the problems are and maybe correct them, and the patient can go on and be okay. So again, the theme here is that aberrant behaviors do not necessarily equal addiction. On slide 102, we want to do a little bit of neurobiology, and so we have a sagittal section of the brain, and we are going to outline three important areas where mu receptors are located, mu opioid receptors. And the first area I'd like to talk about is the periaqueductal gray area, which subserves analgesia. So we are hoping that when we prescribe an opioid analgesic to a patient, that opioid finds its way to the periaqueductal gray area, hooks up to the mu opioid receptor, and by doing that, provides analgesia through different mechanisms. However, when a patient takes an opioid systemically, that opioid will also reach the nucleus accumbens, which is a important part of the limbic system, and that part of the brain subserves reward or euphoria. So some patients, when they take that opioid for pain, will also feel a rewarding experience. They may feel the relief of anxiety or depression. As people take the opioids regularly, we've already discussed physical dependence and withdrawal, and that occurs posteriorly in an area of the brain called the locus coeruleus, which is the main noradrenergic center of the brain. This is important because if the opioid is withdrawn suddenly, the patient will develop withdrawal, and that withdrawal is coming because the locus coeruleus is now secreting excessive amounts of norepinephrine because the opioid was taken away, which kept the norepinephrine in balance. So the point of this slide is that Mother Nature uses the same mu opioid receptor in many different parts of the brain and also other parts of the body. For example, in the GI tract, there are mu opioid receptors which subserve constipation. So depending on where the mu opioid receptors are located in the brain, there will be a different reaction to that receptor. And people who are vulnerable to getting addicted to opioids will feel more of a reward than people who are not vulnerable to becoming addicted to opioids. Substance use disorders on slide 103 does not happen quickly. It takes time to develop. And substance use disorders follow a certain logical cycle. All substance use disorders start with intake of the substance. And the initial phase of intake is generally perceived as pleasurable or euphoric. And this is called the binge intoxication stage. And the euphoria is because dopamine and endogenous opioids are released by the drug in the limbic system. As the use of the drug continues, as tolerance is developing, as physical dependence and withdrawal start to occur, the person now, rather than experiencing euphoria and pleasure, is going into withdrawal every few hours, and withdrawal is a very dysphoric state to be in. So although the drug is no longer supplying pleasure to the patient continues to use the drug not for pleasure, but for relief of negative symptoms of withdrawal. This has been termed the dark side of addiction or negative reinforcement. And the final stage, which is developing alongside some of the others, is in the frontal cortex. There is now preoccupation with the drug use. There is craving. There is anticipation of the drug use. And the cycle continues around and around. On the left-hand side, you see the listing of neurotransmitters. And so in each one of these cycles, there are different neurotransmitters which are making the behaviors occur. And so, for example, in the withdrawal negative affect part of the cycle, corticotropin releasing factor and dynorphin, which are dysphorogenic, are playing a role. And in the preoccupation craving part of the cycle, glutamate seems to be the main neurotransmitter. And this is one way to try to understand why substance use disorder is occurring and why it persists despite negative consequences. On slide 104, we're going to talk about vulnerability to opioid use or opioid use disorder. Most people who take a prescription opioid do not develop an opioid use disorder, but there are people who are vulnerable to developing an opioid use disorder. Certainly, those with psychiatric comorbidities are vulnerable. Very often, this is termed self-medication, where the opioid is relieving anxiety, depression, PTSD symptoms. So there's an interesting statistic here, and that is 51% of prescribed opioids wind up going to the 19% of people who have mental health disorders in the United States. This has been termed adverse selection, that the population most likely to develop an opioid use disorder are the ones who get most of the opioids prescribed to them. The bottom box is going over something that has been repeated in many studies, shown to be correct in many studies, and that is that as a person uses an opioid, let's say in the post-operative scenario, the more days they stay on the opioid, the higher the doses of the opioid, the more likely they are to develop an opioid use disorder as time goes by. And this can even be a matter of a week or 2 weeks making a difference. And so the message is that the patient should be prescribed the least amount of opioids for the least amount of time that they need it, and that they should not continue it past the time that it's absolutely necessary, because they keep increasing their chance of developing an opioid use disorder. If somebody does develop a use disorder, how do we treat it? Well, counterintuitively, we have the best pharmacotherapy for the treatment of opioid use disorder when compared to all other substance use disorders. And the medications that we have are methadone, which is a Schedule II medication and has been used for approximately 50 years. We have buprenorphine, which is a Schedule III medication, and that has been used in America for almost 20 years now. And then we have naltrexone, which is not a controlled substance and is available in both a PO tablet form and also a more commonly used IM depot injection given once every 4 weeks. Those are the three FDA-approved medications for the treatment of opioid use disorder. In general, but not always, adding psychosocial treatments such as cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, contingency management, mutual help groups like AA and NA increase the likelihood of a successful outcome. Other issues like housing, child care, legal issues, criminal justice issues, employment issues, if they can be addressed, then outcomes are better as well. There are many formulations now of the medications that we use for the treatment of opioid use disorder. And so, for example, a person could take a daily tablet of naltrexone, or they could be given a once monthly injection. We now have a subcutaneous monthly injection of buprenorphine versus daily sublingual administration. There has been ongoing controversy as to how long should somebody stay on effective treatment, pharmacotherapy treatment of opioid use disorder. And the answer really is, based on good evidence over 50 years, that it should be indefinite treatment and that there should not be a rush to taper and get off the treatment. And the reason is that, unfortunately, relapse rates are high with opioid use disorder. It is estimated in many studies that the rate of relapse approaches 90% in people who leave effective treatment. And unfortunately, this is a number that has stayed the same over the last 40 years. On slide 106, we're going to discuss the difficult clinical situation of a patient who has both an opioid use disorder and chronic pain. And this is not easy to deal with. It's a difficult clinical scenario, but the first bullet is true, that somebody who has an opioid use disorder, who has pain, if the pain is not treated appropriately by a healthcare provider, they will resort to illicit opioids, whether that be opioid analgesics or a drug like heroin. So the best strategy is to address both pain and opioid use disorder simultaneously. If patients are on opioid analgesics and they're also being monitored by urine drug tests for opioid use disorder, it's advisable to use prescription opioids which do not metabolize to confusing metabolites. So, for example, morphine metabolizes to hydromorphone, oxycodone can metabolize to oxymorphone, and this might cause confusion on a urine drug test. The opioids which do not metabolize to confusing metabolites include methadone, fentanyl, buprenorphine, and hydromorphone. A multidisciplinary program provides the best outcomes. This would be a program that would have a psychiatrist, an addiction medicine specialist, a psychologist, counselors, a physical therapist, etc. These are few and far between. There are often challenges in terms of insurance coverage. However, more of these programs are emerging. On the right-hand side of the slide, we see that buprenorphine has been studied with successful outcomes in patients who have both chronic pain and opioid use disorder. This is the sublingual formulation of buprenorphine, which can be used to treat both opioid use disorder and pain simultaneously. We already discussed bullet number two with the metabolites that can be confusing. Bullet number three is really important. When possible, please try to include significant others. They can help you by securing and dispensing medications, and they can also verify the progress that the patient is making. Also, patients with opioid use disorder should be in some sort of an active recovery program. This might be one-on-one psychotherapy, it might be an NA or AA group, or it might be an outpatient rehab program. And we want to continue to use urine drug testing, the prescription drug monitoring programs, pill counts when appropriate, and patient-provider agreements. Benzodiazepines and opioid analgesics generally don't go together. In over 30% of opioid overdose deaths, benzodiazepines are also found on postmortem toxicology. The FDA has issued black box warnings on both benzos and prescription opioids that, if possible, do not use them simultaneously. It turns out also that people who are tobacco addicted and using excessive amounts of alcohol, both of which are substance use disorders, are at higher risk for misuse of prescribed opioids. And it also turns out that tobacco addicted individuals have less response to opioid analgesics and have a higher pain sensitivity and a lower pain threshold. So many patients with opioid use disorder will have tobacco addiction as well. And if possible, it's a good idea to address that tobacco addiction earlier rather than later in the course of treatment. On slide 108, we're going to zero in on buprenorphine. Buprenorphine can be used to treat pain, and if it's used in the sublingual formulations, that would be off-label use, and no waiver is required to use the sublingual formulations for pain off-label. However, if the sublingual preparations are being used to treat opioid use disorder, then a waiver is required to do that, and other regulations pertain as well. Buprenorphine these days is most commonly prescribed as pharmacotherapy for the treatment of opioid use disorder. It is a partial mu opioid agonist, and unlike the Schedule II opioids like methadone or heroin or oxycodone, buprenorphine has a plateau or ceiling effect, meaning that as you increase the dose, you do not get more mu opioid activity after a certain point is reached, and you get a leveling off of activity at the mu receptor, which provides safety in terms of respiratory depression. Buprenorphine has a very good efficacy profile and a very good safety profile. If buprenorphine is used alone as directed sublingually without use of other CNS depressants like alcohol and buprenorphine, overdoses are extraordinarily rare. If buprenorphine is going to be used primarily for the treatment of pain, there are two FDA-approved formulations which are only approved for pain and cannot be used off-label for the treatment of opioid use disorder. The two formulations approved for pain are, one, a 7-day transdermal patch, which comes in a variety of doses, and also a buccal mucosal film, which also comes in a variety of dosages and is a BID dosing medication. Those two medications have evidence of efficacy for the treatment of chronic pain. There are many resources to help patients with opioid use disorder: the American Society of Addiction Medicine, the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, all have excellent websites with lots of information. There are guidelines on these websites. There are webinars. There are modules. There are policy papers. Also, I would mention that there is an organization which is called PCSS, which provides mentoring services if somebody is new to treating opioid use disorder. This concludes the module on opioid use disorder. Thank you.